From WXXI News, this is Unleash the Pet Show on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, welcome to Unleashed, which gives you the chance to talk to local veterinarians about your pet's health and behavior. And we have a packed hour. I would advise you that if you've got questions about your pet's health or behavior, better to get them in earlier part of the hour, because later in the hour, we're going to be talking about stigma and animals, particularly pit bulls. And we're going to talk to a man who has rescued some of those animals. There's great stories behind this, but we're going to be talking this month and next month on Unleashed about rescue and these kinds of local grassroots organizations that are helping. But that's later in the hour. If you've got questions, it's a great time to do that. And we have Dr. Michelle Brownstein here from Henrietta Animal Hospital. She's in studio with us today. And you can ask a question by calling toll-free right now, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also tweet your question to the hashtag Unleashed or to our producer, Megan Mack. She's on Twitter at MMackMedia. Dr. Michelle Brownstein, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having me.
We were just talking, it's a terrible day to be inside, but you know, some of us have to do it.
We do.
And it's a great day to be outside with your pets. And a lot of people are already asking questions about allergy season. Finally, we've got everything popping. And what are you seeing when it comes to allergy? I guess we can kind of break down allergies in different ways. There's food allergies, there's seasonal allergies, but let's start on the seasonal side. What are you seeing right now?
Seasonal, we see weeds, pollens, trees. We also see inhalant. I categorize those as inhalant allergies. We see environmental allergens. We were talking about dust mites, house mites, storage mites. We see a lot of flea allergies that are popping up right now. So that's really, really a common problem.
Okay. And if you have an animal that has, say, a dog or a cat especially, that has a seasonal allergy, a pollenish kind of an allergy, easy to get that taken care of? Get some help for it?
It's easy to get that taken care of. The hard part is determining what your dog or cat is actually allergic to. Okay. I mean, that's ideally what we like to do. If that's not possible, then we treat symptomatically, and we can do that multiple ways. Commonly, we use steroids. They come with their side effects that we don't necessarily like. Antihistamines can be used in some cases with about a 70% failure rate, but some dogs do respond well to antihistamines. And then we have some newer drugs that are coming down the pike called Apoquil and Atopica that work in a completely different mechanism but are much safer for the long-term use.
Okay. And you said before the program began that you view food allergies as well important this
big
time.
Big component.
All times of year. But go ahead.
And a lot of dogs have multiple. They have the environmental allergens, they have food allergy issues, and they have seasonal allergies. So we see these itchy, scratchy dogs year-round. And sometimes they flare up May, April, May, June, July. I have a dog at home that flares up in August. So in August, he goes on that newer drug we were talking about, Atopica.
What, he flares up with a food allergy?
He flares up with a seasonal allergy.
Allergy.
We did allergy testing on him, and we found specific trees and weeds that he was allergic to. I had the option of preparing serum and injecting him, like with allergy shots, like they do with people, on a weekly basis. But I just decided, since it was only during August, we put him on this medication called Atopica, and he does fine.
Okay. If you have a cat or a dog that has a seasonal allergy, is it more likely to also have a food allergy?
I think so. I think there's a component. It may be a small component, but a lot of it may be a large component, especially if that animal is itching year-round. That's often a heads-up to me that there's probably a food component to this or an environmental component.
Okay, phone's already ringing. Let's get Austin in Canandaigua first up with Dr. Michelle Brownstein from Henrietta Animal Hospital. Go ahead, Austin.
Hi, I had a question regarding cats. So my cat, periodically, if I, you know, unwrap a new whatever, something that's encased in plastic, my cat goes crazy over this piece of plastic. He doesn't eat it. He just licks it constantly throughout the day. Is that okay? Is it bad?
We prefer not. I have a cat that does the same thing. We're not exactly sure what's attracting these cats to plastic. We think there are some chemicals that have a pheromone type of effect on the cats, but ingesting that, which my cat tends to do, is really not good for them. They can obstruct with that or can vomit, so it's really not a good idea. It's not an uncommon problem. It's a great question.
Oh, okay. All right, great. Thanks.
Austin, thanks very much. I guess the key there, Austin, saying the cat's not eating the plastic or ingesting the plastic.
Right, just licking it.
Okay. And It makes me wonder the same thing about the way our cats rub their face on shoes. What is going on there?
Well, cats have scent glands in their face, and cats are very tactile animals, and they're just kind of putting their scent on your shoes, or they're rubbing up against you, up against your leg with their faces. They're putting their scent on you.
Well, and there's no doubt. I mean, they do that thing where they rub their face on the corner of every wall.
Everything.
About four or five times just to make sure they leave that scent. But shoes in particular, it looks like a drug for them.
And it's probably got a heavy, no offense to you, Evan, but probably a strong scent from you that are on those shoes. So
excuse
they're just,
me.
Yeah. Sorry about that. But there's probably a strong scent.
Maybe
there.
Some environmental scents as well, probably
could
coming
be.
In from outside.
Could be.
Okay. But again, nothing to worry about there.
Nothing to worry about.
Okay. We always just found it a little strange. This is Kathy in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Kathy.
Hi. I have an 11-year-old Shih Tzu dog, and he's developed warts. He's healthy, all aside from everything else, but he's just got these warts on his skin.
Oh, Kathy, I'm so sorry for you. Those can be really frustrating. They are non-painful. They're irritant mostly when the dog's going to be groomed or if they're becoming extensive and they really interfere with the grooming. They become problematic when they're in the eyes and between the toes. So there are ways to take those off that are non-traumatic. Some veterinarians have the ability to remove them by cryosurgery or freezing them off. Others simply cauterize them off, but generally they're not going to harm your pet at all.
Right. Now, does this require anesthesia? I mean, he's 11 years old, and he's fairly healthy, but, you know, my groomer's great. I mean, she takes care of his haircuts and does a beautiful job. But she says, you know, just leave them alone. But they're kind of, you know, they're getting more and more.
Age should never be a deterrent to doing anesthesia or sedation for your pet or doing procedures like mass removals or dentals. As long as your pet is healthy, has had preoperative lab work, that should not deter you from making the decision to have those removed.
Okay, fine. Thank you so much for your advice.
Sure.
Thanks, Kathy, for the phone call. Listeners, if you've got a question for Dr. Brownstein about your pets, your animals, you can call toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI in Rochester, 263-9994. How common is the problem that Kathy just described?
We see it a lot with small dogs, and some can have one or two, and some can have multiple. I worry about the ones that are on the eyelids. Those are my problems, and sometimes in the ear canals.
We've been talking about medication, sometimes allergy medication. We have in our house two older cats, 15 and 14. The 15-year-old, every night with dinner, we have to give her a quarter of a pill for blood pressure. So I just kind of grind it up, put it in the food, let her eat first. Once in a while, she's really sort of stubborn about eating, and I'm going, do you need me to lock you in the bed? Don't make me lock you in. You got to eat this. Aww. You have to do it. And the other one's generally very patient. But there are times where I wonder, if we're not careful, if animals are ingesting each other's medications, do you ever see that? What's the concern there?
Well, that happens when you're putting it in the food and then walking away, so that is a problem. So
that's why
I like
we monitor
to make sure,
closely, yeah.
Make sure, I mean, bringing up, it's a great point about giving medication to cats. One of the beauties that we have now in veterinary medicine are what are called transdermal medications, that these medications like you're using can be put into a gel and rubbed into the pet's ear. Very slick, very easy, non-traumatic way to administer medication.
Into the ear?
Rubbed it into the inside of the ear.
Wow. And it's
kind of like nitroglycerin.
Like a gel?
Like a gel.
And they let you do that?
They let you do that. I mean, my cats, I have four at home, are not great about taking pills, I've got to admit. So one of them gets medication rubbed into his ears twice a day.
Ooh. You know, cats generally don't like you to stick their finger in their ears, but I guess it beats having a pill jammed down their throat.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is why we grind up the quarter of the pill that we give and put it on the top of the food and just give her a small amount until she eats it. The problem is,
you got to sit there.
I sit there. There are times I just sit there going, how much of my life am I spending with this cat? I'm just waiting for you to eat this. So what's it? You called it transdermal?
It's called a transdermal gel, like nitroglycerin paste that used to be put on in the old days. The guys that had heart problems, they would put that on their chest, and that's the way it go through the skin. And some of these even can be compound. One of my cat takes medication because the transdermal does not work on him. He takes it in a flavored chew. Takes it right down like there was no tomorrow.
All right, let's try to grab one more phone call before our very short break. This is Caitlin in Rochester next up with Dr. Michelle Brownstein. Go ahead, Caitlin.
Hi. I have two questions about my one cat. My one cat, he tips to eat really fast, and he throws up all the time that he keeps And then secondly, he's also pretty overweight, but I do see him on his schedule according to the directions on the bed. I still want to do about both of those issues.
So, Caitlin, just let me jump in and say, I hope you're still listening on your radio. Just the quality of the call might be just sort of depends on where you're calling from. I think we just lost the quality. I couldn't hear it.
I heard overweight cat. That's
yeah, okay.
Heard.
So, Caitlin, please call back, and maybe we'll establish a better connection. Let's do this. Let's take our very short break, and we'll come back because I know the phone's ringing, and there's more calls and questions coming in for Dr. Michelle Brownstein from Henrietta Animal Hospital, sharing her time with us this hour on Unleashed the Pet Show right here on Connections. Welcome back to Unleashed the Pet Show right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and as I mentioned, our engineer John Andrus grabbing your phone calls right now. So we'll get back to your phone calls and questions for Dr. Brownstein in just a second. But just kind of piggybacking on what we've been talking about when it comes to possible allergies or risks to your animals, your pets this time of year. Spring, a lot more flowers, a lot more blossoms popping, etc. When we're walking our dogs, they like to eat and sniff everything. Anything that's toxic out there that you want to make sure when you're out walking the dog or the dog's in a park that they are not eating. And on the flower side, that kind of thing.
That's a list that's so extensive. Off the top of my head, there's lilies of the valley, foxglove, oleander, nightshade, some of the apple, the branches, the leaves contain toxins. Basically, just don't let your dog ingest anything while you're out on a walk.
Okay.
It's the safest thing that you can do.
How often do you see it?
I don't see poisonings. We get the phone calls, but most of the time, those are referred directly to the ASPC poison control.
Oh, yeah.
And I can give your listeners a phone number if they want to keep
handy. Yeah, please
do. 888-426-4435. That's ASPCA poison control.
Let's do that number one more time.
888-426-4435. Now, there is a charge for that phone call, but if you have some of the certain microchips that are implanted, sometimes that fee is waived. So that's a good number to have, and they will tell you exactly what to do, whether it's going to cause a little bit of GI upset and not much to worry about, or you need to induce vomiting, mm-hmm. don't induce vomiting, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Let me get back to the phones. Joan in Hilton is next up. Go ahead, Joan.
Hi. Hey, how you doing? Trying to find out if you have any magic formula. I've got a 17-year-old Jack Russell that has a upper respiratory infection. He got it actually at the vet, so he's had it like 6-7 weeks now, and we've been treating him with antibiotics on and off and our inflammatory medication. I've been putting him in the hot shower room with me. And he just doesn't seem to shake it. I know he's older, and that's probably the problem, but I don't know if they have any ideas.
That's a great question. Thanks for taking in this Jack Russell, by the way. 6 to 7 weeks is a long time for a dog to have an upper respiratory tract infection, so it's probably time to be doing some more diagnostics. It may be pneumonia that's gotten really bad. It may be heart disease that's causing the cough. It may be problems with his windpipe. So certain diagnostic tests are probably in order, especially checking for heartworm disease on an unknown dog. That can cause coughing as well.
He's not coughing. That's the thing. He just a lot of snot coming out of his nose. Pardon the expression, but yeah.
There can be other causes for that. There, you know, primary nasal infections are really rare, so there could be a foreign body stuck up there. There can be a fungal infection, or in serious cases, there can be even tumors up there. So I really urge you to get more diagnostics done.
Okay. Great advice. Thank
you. Sure. Best of luck.
Thank you, Joan. Thanks for the phone call. Caitlin is back on line one. Caitlin, go ahead.
Hello. So sorry about that before.
No problem.
So the two questions on the same cat. One, my cat does throw up most times he eats, at least a week. I do feed him on a schedule to try to prevent him from eating too much too quickly. And then the second thing is he is pretty overweight. He's only 7 years old, and he's probably about 13 pounds, and I do feed him according to the bag. But I'm not sure what I can do about his weight, and then also if there's something else I should be doing to help avoid him from throwing up as much as he is.
All right, Caitlin, stay on the line.
Okay.
Go ahead, Doctor.
So you've got multiple problems here. You've got a cat that's regurgitating, it sounds like, undigested food, so he's bringing it back up.
Correct.
Could be a result of him eating too fast. It could be he's not tolerating the food you're feeding him, and he may have a food sensitivity. So if it's, especially if it's fish-based, chicken-based, some cats don't do well on those kind of diets.
Okay.
So I'd encourage you to see your veterinarian on that. There could be other causes for that chronic regurgitation as well.
Okay.
Weight control is really important. If he's overweight, we need to get the weight off of him. And dry food tends to be really high in carbs, and we're trending now towards higher protein diets for cats because they're carnivores. So again, talk to your veterinarian, see how much weight he needs to lose, and talk to your veterinarian about getting him on, getting that weight off and getting that regurgitation under control.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for your time.
Sure.
Thanks, Caitlin, for the phone call. I hear, by the way, doctor, and some debate in the vet community about dry food. I've heard from some who say it's almost like candy for cats. They
it
love
is.
To eat it. They will eat more of it, and it's harder to regulate than wet food. Do you agree?
It's kitty crack, yeah. It's really high in carbs, and they get really addicted to it. The problem is it's convenient. So,
yeah.
And the feline specialists are saying, give these guys canned food, but you're walking a razor edge on the canned food because it enhances dental diseases. It's more expensive. It's more messy. So I kind of walk an edge on that, little bit of dry, mostly canned.
Okay.
And check your protein levels.
All right, let's get one more phone call in. Susan in Shortsville, next up. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, Evan. If you're pilling your cat, take a popsicle stick. I had a cat that had to have not only potassium gel, but the blood pressure medicine and sepsis because he had kidney issues. So I'd put the gel on the end of a popsicle stick. You hold their head from behind, just pop their mouth open and rub it on the back of their tongue, and they swallow it, and then you don't have to sit there and wait. Because he wouldn't eat the medicine.
And that worked for you?
Oh, it worked great. Yeah, yeah. And I also ended up doing subcutaneous fluids for him, too, for his kidney disease. He passed just 3 weeks ago, so... the other cat and I are still in mourning, but he was great about it, yeah.
Well, thanks for the phone call, Susan, and thanks for the recommendation. I guess, Dr. Brownstein, there's a lot of different things that might work.
Whatever it takes for a cat.
But if you missed it earlier, what I had not really heard about was this sort of gel in the ear that you are at least saying, look into that.
Look into that.
That may be the easiest.
Yeah, easiest, yep.
Okay. Now, speaking of losing our pets, and you just heard Susan mention it, it can be very difficult. When we bring pets into our lives, obviously there's a good chance that we're going to outlive them. And it's tough. Licensed social worker Amy Jewett has a private practice that focuses primarily on loss and change. She counsels many grieving pet owners, and our Beth Adams spoke to her about how to navigate those emotions.
What are most people looking for when they come to you following the loss of a pet, do you think?
Well, I think that they are sometimes surprised by the depth of their grief, and that they need reassurance that what they're moving through is what ought to be happening. And I think, you know, within our culture, the death of a pet can be trivialized. So one wonders if the pain is of greater depth than they anticipated, or lasting longer than they anticipated, that they need sometimes reassurance that this is the path that grief follows.
I know that in my own personal situation, saying goodbye to pets, and what many other people have told me, is that they sometimes cried harder for the loss of a pet than they did for a person, perhaps, who died.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes these animals are our pseudo-children, right?
They are. They do play a surrogate role in our lives. And the relationships that we have with our pets is a simple relationship for the most part. It does not have the complexities that a person-to-person relationship can have. It's simple, it's pure, it enriches our lives in so many ways. So when we lose the pet, much of what we were enjoying by way of the relationship is gone, and it is a profound loss.
So, Amy, how do you guide your clients through the grieving process? And are there general recommendations or tips you can offer for someone who is grieving a lost pet?
Well, I think that it's very important to help them acknowledge that the relationship has ended. And I think that we do that by way of expression of our feelings. So we certainly spend a great deal of time normalizing the response, and I do that by way of talking about the many ways that one's life is enriched by way of the bond. And then I encourage them to express what they're feeling about the loss, to tell me about the pet, stories about the pets, and also the decline of the pet and the actual ending of the pet's life. And I also encourage them to talk to people who will be supportive, not to try to explain one's response to someone who doesn't have the capacity to understand how deeply felt something like this can be.
When you and I were talking off the air earlier, we were talking about the different forms grief can take. It can hit people differently. And you mentioned complex grief. This is when maybe you left the door open and your cat got out and got hit by a car.
Yes.
Or
yes.
You had to euthanize an animal, and maybe you're struggling with, was it the right time?
Exactly. I think the decision to euthanize can be a struggle at times. Are we perhaps doing ending the relationship too soon? Should we have waited longer? Should we have taken the animal sooner? And it can become particularly complex if there has been an accident involved. If someone has, for example, been the last person to let the cat out of the door and it runs across the street and gets hit by a car, then, you know, the guilt is very profound.
And what is the pathway out of that layered grief?
Well, again, I think that it needs to be discussed in the fullest of ways by exploring all the feelings that are associated with that situation.
What emotional or behavioral problems would be a sign that someone should seek professional help when they're grieving the loss of a pet?
Okay. I think that's such a good question. The literature would tell us that prolonged grief would reflect some sort of a problem within the process. And I think it suggests that more than the loss of the pet is being grieved.
When you talk about prolonged,
I would say months long would be excessive. And also, I think if there is no emotional response, you know, this signals repression. And that can be a problem. That takes a great deal of energy to repress one's feelings around such an event.
Sometimes we feel disloyal to our departed pet when we start to think about getting a new pet. I hear people say this all the time. And how do we work through those feelings and know when is the right time to add a new member of the family when we lost one recently?
Yeah, that's I find that to be a kind of a hard question to answer, because I think it's my personal belief that we can grieve and experience joy at the same time. So I don't know if there are any hard and fast guidelines.
That's good to know. The grief and the joy can live side by side.
Absolutely.
It's not one or the other, and you don't have to shut your grief off or stop mourning or missing.
That's right.
To have happiness in a new friend.
And I don't think that we ever completely stop grieving. I think that we will always miss each and every one of our pets. And I think I mentioned to you earlier that I think it's brave to be a pet owner, because it is a much shorter lifespan than we experience. And we know that we're going to eventually have to deal with the loss of that pet.
And that is Beth Adams talking to licensed social worker Amy Jewett, talking about dealing with the grief that follows the death of a pet, which has to be, Dr. Brownstein, for you, the worst part of the job.
It is the worst part of the job. It is the worst part of the job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can just sense, I've known you for 30 minutes, and the bedside manner you have in talking to callers. You've got a great manner with them. And You know, do you ever sort of, I mean, to some degree, you have to desensitize a little to it, but do you ever sort of totally kind of disengage from the emotion?
I never do, especially when you've had an animal that you've had since a puppy or a kitten to 16, 17, 18 years of life, and you've seen that puppy and the family mature with that animal. It's really tough, and I can never detach myself.
I was in fifth grade. I'll never forget. I was a fifth grader when we lost our first time I lost a pet. It was a dog, a collie named Katie, and I remember my mother asking, "Do you want to come with us?" And I said, I can't do it. And I just remember sitting in my room and crying and feeling, and then, you know, sort of years later feeling like, how could I not have been there? I needed to be there. But, you know, I was in fifth grade and it was lost like I had never experienced it. So, but everybody's different, I guess.
The pangs are still there.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. All right, well, I want to get through a couple more questions that have come in from various sources for Dr. Michelle Brownstein. Again, here from Henrietta Animal Hospital. A question about Giardia, or I guess is it Giardiasis? Giardia is the... I heard of Giardia years ago when I was covering a story down in Yates County. We were covering a story on puppy mills.
Yep.
And a lot of the dogs, the puppies there, ended up having Giardia, unclean conditions. But refresh for me and the listeners, what is Giardia?
It's a parasite that lives in the intestinal tract of puppies and kittens. Generally comes from unsanitary conditions. It can be transmitted to people, so it is a human health hazard. Sometimes tough to diagnose. So sometimes we go ahead and we symptomatically, when we suspect it, we symptomatically put these pets on specific medication to knock it out. But it is a tough one sometimes to diagnose because the pet's not always shedding that organism.
And if you end up with a puppy or essentially an infant animal, a young animal that has Giardia, you know, is there... Does it go away? Is there a cure? What can you do?
It usually needs a specific treatment, especially if it's affecting the puppy and it's giving them diarrhea. So it needs to be specifically treated with a drug called either Flagyl or a drug called Fabendazole. Easy to treat. Sometimes if the animal keeps reinfesting itself, you have to look at hygiene. So you have to be meticulous with your hygiene with your pet.
And Giardia can be dangerous, right?
It can be life-threatening, especially in these young puppies. In kittens.
Okay. Ear infections can also be a problem. We've had some questions about ear infections. What are the symptoms for our dogs and cats?
Well, first thing I'd like to say about ear infections is it is not a disease. It's a symptom of something else that's going on. And commonly, it's allergies, more commonly food allergies. Thyroid disease is a common problem. So when I see an ear infection, I tell a client with their pet, this is a symptom and there's something else going on. So we need to treat it. We treat it symptomatically with ear cleansers and topical medication, but the probability that's going to recur is high unless we treat the underlying condition. And symptoms are dog or cat shaking, scratching their head, whining when you touch the ear, digging at the ear, those are all signs of ear infection.
So again, if you've got a pet that has a recurring ear infection, that means there's something else going on.
Absolutely.
Okay, and get that checked out. Marion writes to us and wants to know, what foods support cats' dental health? Any foods that actually support dental health?
Can I drop back and say the best thing that you can do for preventing dental disease is by brushing your cat's teeth? If that's not a problem, then we go to dental foods. And there are various prescription diets that have dental diets that are specific for controlling dental disease. Still not as good as active brushing because everything else is passive control. Certain treats are high in tartar control as well, and they help.
I was in the category of so many pet owners, cat owners especially, where you go and you think, do I really want to spend, you know, for a real dental cleaning at the vet? And because you know that it's going to be expensive, or at least, you know, I mean, everything's relative, but they can be very expensive. And, you know, your cat's not talking to you. You don't have that communication where they're saying, well, it hurts to eat. It hurt. And so eventually we did, and I will never question it. After seeing the before and after, I was stunned. I felt guilty as a pet owner. But it was a great lesson to be learned because, look, you can look it up, and I'm sure you've had questions. People saying, is this a scam? You know, right. Do I really need to spend this much money? Right. But what you seem to be saying is, first of all, if you can brush before even taking to the vet, that's a good start.
Right. Absolutely. If you can do brushing a couple of times a week, we strive for daily, but if you can brush your pet's teeth a couple of times a week, you're going to avert so much in dental costs because, as you say, the pets don't cry out. We see typical signs, start to decrease eating, food drops out of their mouth. By then, the teeth, we can't save the teeth, and we have to do extractions.
Dr. Brownstein, we are a society that can barely floss our own teeth a couple
exactly.
times a week.
Exactly.
But we've got a lot
exactly.
of room to go.
But then again, we don't have to be anesthetized for our dental
no,
procedures.
You're right.
So.
Well, sometimes. but very good advice there. And again, I would just say, you know, honestly, that was so eye-opening, seeing the before and after.
Yeah, it is.
Let's get our last short break of the hour, and we're going to come back and talk about stigma in animals. And mentioned pit bulls. If you saw the Democrat and Chronicle, Dave Andreotta had a piece today about mail carriers and pit bulls. And you might have heard NPR Terry Gross in Fresh Air talking to an author of a new book called Pit Bull. We're going to talk about that next. Coming up in our second hour, it's Second Opinion Live, and we're taking your questions on headache. Everything from common headaches, tension headaches, cluster headaches, migraine, and more. Treatments, research, therapy, even preventive approaches. What can you be doing to make yourself and your head feel better? It's next hour on Second Opinion Live.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Major funding for Unleashed the Pet Show on Connections comes from Rufus Kendig, the Richard T. Bell Foundation, and from the Lilliputian Foundation. Little grants making a big difference.
Welcome back to Unleash the Pet Show. You might have heard recently on Fresh Air that Terry Gross interviewed Bronwyn Dickey, the author of a new book called Pit Bull. The book looks at the history of the breed and how the American public shifted its perception of pit bulls. Dickey writes that for decades, pit bulls were symbols of all kinds of positive American traits. But then dogfighting became more prevalent and more deadly, and American preferences shifted to other breeds. Meanwhile, the Humane Society tried to intervene in dogfighting, trying to help the dogs, but there was an unfortunate consequence as well. Here's author Bronwyn Dickey on Fresh Air, describing what happened starting in the 1970s.
There was a very well-intentioned move made by the humane movement to eradicate what was left of professional dog fighting because it was growing so brutal and sadistic. And because they operated in different states, they were very hard to catch. So in order to make that crime a felony, the humane movement enlisted the help of the media, and there was this kind of media blitz to bring dog fighting to the forefront of the American mind and make people care, but it turned into kind of a speculative free-for-all, and the dogs really got caught in that. And so once people started reading stories about these dogs called pit bulls that had these supposedly horrific characteristics, all the people who were already selecting dangerous dogs then just basically switched which dog they wanted.
So that's Bronwyn Dickey talking to Terry Gross on Fresh Air. And I want to welcome our next guest to the program. It's Joel Helfrich. He is a historian, a professor of history and environmental sciences, and a man who's responsible for the rescue of a number of local pit bulls. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, next month on this program, we're going to take a closer look at, well, I guess what I would just call smaller rescue groups, more of the grassroots. And this is nothing against, you know, sort of the big organizations. We all know Lollipop, things like that. But there are smaller groups. Pity Love is one. We're going to talk to them. We're going to talk to some others. Joel, you're responsible for a number of, I think, some really heartwarming stories, but some tough stories as well. I'd like you to tell one that sparked some of this conversation. It's the story of Vortex, who I hope I can meet in the next month, and we'll tell more of that story. But well, let's start there. 2014? Is that when it happened?
I think that was January 2014. That sounds about right. So as the story goes, a gentleman had driven to the emergency vet with a pit bull, and he walked in and said, "I'd like to surrender my dog." And it turned out that, you know, the emergency vet is not a place to surrender animals, nor are they going to take in animals. So he proceeded to go out to his truck and let the dog go. So this was during the polar vortex. It was 6 degrees out. And for the next 48 hours, a group of individuals, or at times about 30 of us, basically traipsed around the woods behind MCC, along the canal.
Well, how did you hear about it? You had been contacted?
My partner and I had seen a dog on a highway running around near MCC earlier in the day. And we made some phone calls and learned that there was a collection of people who were gathering to try and find this dog. It seemed as if Pity Love, the local rescue group, took the lead, and through social media, they reached out to a number of people. So I basically just showed up with, you know, full weather gear and spent a good portion of the next 2 days walking around trying to find this dog.
In 6 degree, probably less, probably negative with the wind chill. I mean, we all remember this past winter was mild, but the previous two were really, really tough. So that's, and what happened?
So after almost exactly 2 days of this type of work, we caught up with the dog. He had gone down the Erie Canal, he'd gone back up the Erie Canal and so forth, and he cut through the prison area near the prison, went through MCC's campus, and then proceeded to go across the six or so lanes of traffic on East Henrietta Road, and eventually went behind, I think it's Rustic Village there. And so I was on foot, another person was in their car, and we basically just tried to keep up with this dog who was still running. And I got about two blocks away from him, and I realized that he had gone into this enclosed area. And I'd never been back there, so I thought, you know, everything's going through my head at that moment. I thought, well, this looks like it's a dog run. And sure enough, it was a dog park that was enclosed. And here I am in my boots and my gloves and my hat just trying to catch up with this dog. And he had gone in there, and I shut the gate. And then I said a little prayer that he wasn't going to jump the 4-foot-high fence. And within about half an hour, we convinced him that it was okay to trust us, and with treats, got him out of the area and got him to the vet. And unfortunately, in his case, really, there was nothing medically wrong with him other than his paws were bloodied. Sure. And his nails were pretty much down to the quick. But, you know, he had essentially been walking for 48 hours at that point.
Wow. And you make it seem, I think you tell the story very sort of modestly and kind of quickly, but that half hour where you're working to convince him, you know, this isn't a dog that you've met before. This is a dog that's been out in really, really rough weather. And how did you? You know, you can't run up to the dog and say, come with us, buddy. You know, what was that half hour like?
Well, I mean, it was a lot of people who were better at it than I was. So, you know, I just was fortunate enough to close the door. And some of the other folks came along with, you know, treats. And essentially, he just kept eating treats. And eventually
was probably hungry, yeah.
Was willing to let somebody put a long lead on him. And once he got on the leash, he literally just, you know, walked ahead of the folks, and he walked right out of the enclosed area. So this was a dog that was not underweight. He looked like he had been cared for, as if he had been in a good home for a while. And for whatever reasons, he had been let go. We still don't understand. And the person who let him go still hasn't come forward to say, hey, that was me. So we will never know exactly what his life was like before that January day.
How old do we think he is now?
I'm not sure. He might be 5 years old. He might be three. I'm not sure what his age is.
Well, we're going to reach out to Pity Love in the next month. I'm going to try to meet Vortex and, you know, maybe do a nice little interview with him. We'll see what he sounds like. But I think if you check out Pity Love online, Vortex is up for adoption. There are others. And Joel, you know, you heard the interview that Terry Gross did with Bronwyn Dickey, who wrote the book called Pitbull. And she looks at the history. And she talked about how when the sort of the humane movement got involved, they wanted to shut down dogfighting, which was a good thing. But then it became this idea that, well, pit bulls are fighters, first and foremost, and mostly fighters, and that they're almost willing participants in it,
right,
as opposed to, you know, sort of being tortured and mistreated. And that became the stigma that went with it. Why do you think that stigma persists today, to the extent that it does? Not everywhere, but why do you think it persists in some ways?
I mean, I think that people hold on to these myths about the pit bull, the American pit bull, and I think that that's changing. You know, we're seeing it here in this community. We're seeing it amongst celebrities. We're seeing it in various cities across the United States. You know, we have to remember that the history of this particular dog is that they were the American dog. You know, through much of the 20th century, they were the golden lab or the golden retriever or the Labrador retriever. And they were the nanny dog. They were basically left in charge of children. And we get that in The Little Rascals. We get that in various film series throughout the 20th century. So people are starting to reconnect with that past and realize that these are incredible dogs who are not, you know, fighters. They're basically taught or trained to be that way. They get a bad rap because they are strong, you know, but they are amazing, amazing dogs.
I guess if you were going to breed an animal, if you were going to weaponize a dog, you probably aren't going to choose a dachshund. You're probably going to choose a dog that's muscular, it's
right.
got a strong jaw. But Dr. Brownstein, you see all kinds of breeds.
I do.
And, you know, I know you've probably seen a range of pit bulls and a range of issues related to that. What do you make of the question of stigma with this breed?
Well, I think it's unfortunate. And this happens with other breeds, but there are other breeds that are equally as destructive and equally as dangerous as the pit bull, but don't get near the bad rap that the pit bull gets. I've seen good pit bulls, and I've seen not so good pit bulls. I've seen good Rottweilers, and I've seen Rottweilers that will take your face off. So every breed has to be evaluated for its good characteristics and its bad characteristics, and you have to look at the way the animal was brought up. I personally think that pit bulls start out bad when they get their ears cropped. They experience this huge amount of pain, and if they were left alone, I think they would develop into nicer dogs. I'm not a big fan of ear cropping, but I think inflicting that on these young puppies is not a great start in life.
Joel, how many pit bulls do you have?
We have one pit bull. He's a rather big guy, but he is the biggest love of all. You know, he wants to just kiss you and sit in your lap, and even though he's 82 pounds, he is just the biggest love, and he's been, you know, pretty much bitten by every single dog that he's come into contact with, and he just takes it essentially, and kind of wonders why these dogs are biting him when all he wants to do is play and kiss and lick. And so, you know, he's just an incredible little guy, and he's really taught me so much about pit bulls in general. You know, when I first met him, he was coming down a hill, and everything went through my brain in a flash, trying to think, well, you know, they say you're not supposed to show fear, and I'm just going to, you know, be excited and animated and so forth. And meanwhile, I'm thinking this dog is huge, and he's walking down a hill toward me. And, yeah. you know, I had all these beliefs about pit bulls at the time that, you know, through my own ignorance that I had to overcome and overcame because of this this guy. So, and fortunately, I've come into contact with other pit bulls since then. In part because of the work that my partner does. So she just in January actually rescued a pit bull from the Adirondacks. And this was a dog that was posted on Rescue Me, one of the rescue sites online. And basically the posting went like this. My husband and I are going on vacation for 4 months, and we have a date set to kill our dog, to euthanize our dog. So January 2nd, Molly, this wonderful pit bull, who had Lyme disease because she was on a huge farm and just was let run free. These folks said, we're going to euthanize, basically kill our dog. And we're going to do that on January 2nd. We have the whole dog in our backyard. And furthermore, we're going to pick up on Monday and leave for our 4 month long vacation. And Valerie said, you know, I don't care what the circumstances is, that dog's not going to die. So we met these folks in Seneca Falls, New York. They dropped her off with us. She hopped right into the car, and she's been in foster with a family that we've known for 30 or 40 years. And what's interesting about the story, in addition to the kind of horror of the whole thing, is that she's alive, she's doing well, she's, you know, getting healthier every day and recovering from her Lyme disease. And furthermore, the family that took her in loved German Shepherds and didn't want to have a pit bull. In fact, when Valerie talked to them on the phone, they said, well, there was this kind of moment of pause where they were kind of processing this. And they love her like crazy. She follows around the guy in the house. Their son lives with them. She's become part of their family. And she's just an incredible, you know, another kind of incredible teacher.
And by the way, Dr. Brownstein, we've talked Lyme disease on this program in recent months, but just what's the reminder for listeners that if your animal gets Lyme disease, what do you do?
Well, first of all, it's a hard disease to diagnose, so you want to prevent the disease is the key. So the key to preventing the disease is preventing your dog from getting exposed to ticks. So talk with your veterinarian about a good tick prevention, checking your dog when you come in from the woods for ticks in between the feet, toes, ears. We are seeing Lyme disease almost across the board. We're diagnosing it routinely on a daily basis. if it gets infected, there are medications that we can put it on to get rid of the acute infection. But if it goes chronic, just like with people, it's hard to diagnose and hard to get rid of.
But not a death sentence.
Absolutely not a death sentence. We see a lot of dogs that turn positive on the heartworm test that we run. It's a four-way test. It tests for heartworm disease and three other tick-transmitted diseases. When they come positive, all that means is they've been infected with the disease. They've had an infection at some point. It doesn't mean that they're actively infected.
Okay. Joel, before we let you go, and we're running out of time for the hour here, you know, we're going to spend some time in the next month learning a little bit more about rescue groups in general. And I know you know some of them, and it's always amazing to me the big hearts that people have out there. You know, give me an assignment. What should I be doing to kind of learn more about this community that's doing the kind of work that you know, I know you've taken in animals, you know these groups that do. There's probably more out there than we realize, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a number of groups. It's not only for dogs, but also for cats and also for wildlife. So, you know, right off the top of my head, you know, one of the things that people should be talking about are feral cats and all the groups out that are doing not only doing low-cost spay and neutering, but also helping to do trap, neuter, and release, TNR. And so some of those groups are Habitat for Cats, the 19th Ward Community Cats, and Colony Caregiver, just off the top of my head. But then there are also a number of clinics nearby that offer, at some moments, free spay and neuter, depending on whether they have grant money to do so. So that's one thing. Obviously, Pity Love Rescue, there are many others. There are breed-specific rescues, for example, for German Shepherds and other dogs. And there just literally there are tons of dogs that, you know, if you can provide a lifelong commitment to an animal and if you have the resources to provide for that animal, everybody should be, you know, showing compassion and care towards our critters and animals.
Check out Vortex on Pity Love, by the way, online. And I love the name Vortex. And maybe I'll get a chance to meet him in the next month here. I want to grab one more quick phone call on the subject of getting animals fixed. Ryan in Rochester. Go ahead, Ryan.
Hey, I have a 2.5-year-old golden retriever, and he's a crypt orchid, so he has one retained testicle that I actually have an appointment to get him out, to get it out on Monday. I've just been stressing out whether I should get the proper one taken out or not. Because I do a lot of training competitions with him, and now I don't want him to change, you know, physically or behaviorally. So he does have to have the procedure that's a little more invasive no matter what, but I don't know if I should leave the other one in or not.
Go ahead, Dr. Brownstein.
So you're talking about leaving the descended testicle attached?
Correct. Yeah, I was trying to decide if I should leave the proper descended one in, because I know that other one's imperative to get out because it's...
It is. It's got a high chance of becoming a malignancy, but I see no reason why, with what you're doing with your dog, to keep him intact, because he's still going to have the tendency to breed. He's still going to have testosterone. He's still going to be susceptible to prostatic disease, to certain types of cancers. It's not going to change his behavior one bit if he's completely neutered. So if it was my dog, I would completely neuter him.
Okay. Ryan, hope that helps there. And Marion writes, great program. We adopted two sister kittens in August of 2012. One cat got very sick in April. We are still unsure what triggered it, but after months of intervention, including feeding tubes, she lost half her weight and gave up the fight last Friday. We are still grieving. Her sister still sniffs cautiously around the house. We aren't sure if she knows her sister is gone. We, of course, are having family conversations with four older kids about getting another kitten at the end of June. Is that too soon for another cat? What do you think, Dr. Brownstein?
No, I don't think it's too soon. You have I wasn't sure. Were the children involved as well, or just as a family with two kittens and one passed away? That's the impression I got. So I don't think it's too soon to start looking for a new kitten or a new older cat to bring into the household.
Joel, have you heard of the Ten Commandments of Pet Ownership? Is that something you're familiar with?
I think I've seen a cartoon of that on Facebook or somewhere or other online.
A listener named David just sent to me something to check out, Ten Commandments of Pet Ownership, with regards to a number of things, including euthanasia. So David, thanks for sending that along. I will check that out. We covered a lot of ground this hour. And again, next month we'll do more on looking at rescue groups. And Joel Helfertz, thank you so much for not only sharing the story of Vortex and the rescues that you've been involved with, but also kind of opening our eyes, talking about this breed and talking about rescue groups. Great to have you here, Joel.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Brownstein from Henrietta Animal Hospital, Wonderful job here. Our listeners were so appreciative. They say you've got such a great touch with them.
Thanks. So thanks for having me.
Will you come back sometime?
I absolutely will.
We'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
Short break. Second Opinion Live looks at headache, migraine, cluster headache, tension headache, and more, all related to our heads next hour.